This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Frances Rose, my colleague. Frances is the host of Government Matters at WJLA in the nation's capital, speaking with experts, counselors, people who have worked for the government, are in government now, are retired from government, about the challenges of running this apparatus called the U.S. government, in particular the military. And Frances's conversation, most compelling, about the Navy and the Arm and the Air Force. I almost said Army Air Force, Frances. I'm going backwards in time. We begin with the Navy, however, because of the Shipyard Act. That is a new bill in Congress for a lot of money for the shipyard problem. We didn't know out here in America that there was a shipyard problem gap. What is it, Frances? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Thank you, as always, for the invitation. So the gap is the gap between what the United States needs today, potentially needs in the future, as far as building capacity in our fleet, not just the Navy fleet, but the Coast Guard fleet and the private sector fleet, otherwise known as the Merchant Marine fleet, and the capacity that we have today to be able to build those things. Right now, the Navy estimates that the gap is financially about $21 billion between what is necessary and what's available. The Government Accountability Office says that estimate is too low and the gap is actually greater. The Shipyard Act would close that gap by the federal government giving $21 billion to the Defense Department to build public sector shipyard capability and $4 billion to the private sector in order for them to build shipyard capability. The problem, though, is not just the yards themselves. Now, that is one of the problems, and a conversation I had separately recently with the former commandant of the Coast Guard, Admiral Paul Zukov, he said that historically we've had as many as into the 20s operating functional shipyards in the country, and today we have five. So that's a kind of a data point of the gap that exists. But the challenge that the sponsors of this piece of legislation see is for all of the discussion around infrastructure in President Biden's proposed legislation, there's nothing spoken about anywhere for shipyards. And it's not just the facilities, John, it's the people too. There's a shortfall in people who can actually go and build these ships.
Yes, you spoke with Brian Clark, senior fellow director at the Hudson Institute, and Brian made the very careful point that the senior figures in shipyards are retiring. That's the boomers. That's my group retiring and taking with them a lifetime of information about how to build ships, how to get it done, how to move through. And now that there's more money coming, there aren't either there are not enough trained personnel. I wasn't sure, Frances, not enough trained personnel, or it will take some time to train them. Or is it both, Frances?
It's actually both is the problem, John. So if you look at the timeline, this is a timeline that's pretty common across the federal government. There's a trough of employees when the government downsized, and in the military it's attributable in most cases to the Cold War. You had a smaller number of people coming into the workforce to support a downsizing military. Now we're, 30 years after the end of the Cold War, and that smaller number of people is getting smaller because, as you say, the people in the workplace that were 20 to 25 years old that were entering at that time, who have learned over the last 30 years how to really build a ship very well, are now in their early to mid-50s, and 30 years of service in a labor job like that, you're eligible to retire, and these men and women are doing so. And the problem with the shrinkage in the number of shipyards is there are fewer opportunities to attract new talent. And so as the, for example, the Coast Guard is amping up their shipbuilding in a couple of different areas, but you don't know if you're in the shipyard business what your assembly line is going to be like. Assembly line is not the right phrase, but you get the idea. You don't know what the pipeline is like and what you'll be building and when you'll be building it to know what you need your people to learn how to do. And so the workforce is my takeaway from my conversation with Brian, the workforce is as much a problem now and in the future as the capacity of the shipyards, the actual number of ships that would be able to sit in dry dock.
Just when we thought it couldn't be harder to solve this with the amount of money we have, we moved to the Air Force. You spoke to Larry Spencer, retired U.S. Air Force, 37th Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And Larry put it very succinctly. The Navy gets all the attention. They want 355 ships. They want 455 ships. They want shipyards. What do we get? And I thought, yeah, that's right. For example, the B-1 fleet, I believe, has been momentarily scheduled for refit. It was off duty. Now it's on duty. Maybe it's off duty again. The B-52, which is almost as old as I am, Francis. I enjoy saying that. All right. So I say it every time. is the Air Force. That's their ability to deliver strategic weapons around the world. And yet we still don't know what the Air Force needs. And I believe Larry made a very good point. Nobody asks, Francis.
Well, the problem that the Air Force has right now, John, is the Air Force has wanted to retire a number of their platforms for several years. You may recall, it's been 5 years or so ago now, the controversy about retiring the A-10, close air support aircraft, and the Air Force wanted to do it. Most prominent opponent to that was at the time Senator McSally, Congresswoman, and then Senator McSally from Arizona, who was a retired A-10 pilot, and said you can't get rid of that aircraft. The main thing that I thought was especially thoughtful about my conversation with Larry is Larry has made the point on a number of occasions, and this is just the latest. We should be thinking overall about aviation capabilities and not particular programs. And Congress's penchant, and I understand why, is if it's built in my district or it's built in my state, then it's good. And Larry's suggestion is that the Air Force in particular, the military as a whole, would be better served by a formulation of an aviation strategy, determining what capabilities the military as a whole has to project, and then where does that live? Does that live in Army aviation? Does it live in Navy aviation, Marine Corps aviation, or does it live in the Air Force? And then determine what the Air Force needs rather than doing it as a platform-by-platform, almost kind of ad hoc operation. And I would argue, he didn't say this, but I would argue that's not the Air Force's fault. The Air Force has tried to do it. The most recent hearing this week with General Brown and the acting Secretary of the Air Force focused on the platforms that they want to retire so that they can consolidate platforms and they can focus on what they need for what they call the future fight. And essentially, Congress in general and certain members of Congress in particular say, nope, we want to keep making those things. They don't want to deal with having to go back to their districts and say, why aren't we making this plane anymore that was responsible for my job? I can understand the political pressure, but the political pressure doesn't necessarily serve the Air Force or the U.S. military very well.
And 30 seconds, Francis. Is Congress the right place to have this argument? I mean, what you're suggesting is that it's about jobs for members of Congress, not about what the country needs.
Well, the problem is, John, the Constitution is the Constitution, and that's the way the Constitution has decided that we decide these things.
So we have an Air Force of nostalgia. Ah, okay. Fine. Francis Rose, he is the host of Government Matters, WJLA, in the nation's capital. How many ships do we need? We know. How many squadrons do we need? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.